Welcome to Searching for Marna, the podcast focused on tech innovation in finance, fintech. I'm Lloyd Warhead and I'm a headhunter. I'm privileged to spend my days meeting with some of the influencers, leaders and founders in technology and finance, from unicorn companies to financial disruptors. This podcast, we're going to be hearing from these individuals and really try to understand how they got into fintech, what they're doing, what their company is all about, and perhaps some of the trends that they're looking at in the market. Welcome to the podcast, Keith.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Thank you. Pleasure. So it's Keith Gross, and you are the head of UK for Plaid. Plaid, is it?
We will respond to both, but yeah, in the US we would say Plaid. Here everyone would say Plaid, but think of it as tartan pattern, herringbone pattern, connections on a shirt. So that's the story behind the logo there.
Plaid then.
Yeah, it's Plaid. Plaid it is.
Recently, headline press for having been acquired by Visa for somewhere in the realms of 5.3 billion, I believe.
That's the news. Yeah, we're excited about it. I think it's important to note that the acquisition hasn't closed yet, but I think Visa and Plaid are going to be great partners, and we're excited to have a home there.
Fantastic. So we want to understand your bio and understand how you got to work in the head of UK position for Plaid at these exciting times. Literally one of the headline successful businesses in fintech right now. It's a white hot space nonetheless. So to have stood out, there must be an incredible combination of individuals, business strategy, technology, and timing. Before we do that, let's understand a little bit about you as a person right now.
So
born in America.
Yeah, born in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a little college town on the east coast of the US.
And then had a career in Silicon Valley, which we'll go back to with Google. But right now, where are you residing in London?
Right now, I live in Haggerston in a nice little flat. Yeah, I'm trying to lean into the East London vibe, you know, and truly live a fintech startup existence out here.
How does that compare to Silicon Valley?
Oh man, I have to be honest, I love London. San Francisco is beautiful, but just the sort of cosmopolitan, edgy feeling that you get in East London is something really unique, and I think I'm very much excited to be there.
What are you doing for fun in Haggerston?
So I'm a footballer, I should say, or I play soccer in my spare time, and then I would say a bookworm beyond that. So reader, and in previous life when I had more time, was a creative writing minor in college, and so hopefully I'll get back into that as well.
So not been doing that recently.
I haven't had the time.
What would be the next story that you would write?
The next story that I would write? Wow, that's a good question. You know, I honestly think if I was going to get back into it, I'd do something along the Malcolm Gladwell, or, you know, a little bit of a find some great people and great stories that are real life and do a bit more of a nonfiction essay.
That's like our podcast.
It's like our podcast. I'm excited to hear.
Back off, dude.
I'm going to start the outline right after this.
Good. I need a ghostwriter because I'm rubbish at writing. So I've got the people, not the writing talent, that's for sure. So you used to write short stories. What age was this at?
This was in high school and college for me, university. Yeah.
And they were fiction or nonfiction?
They were fiction back then. I had dreams.
But now you've got all serious.
You know, I feel like I've gone through, as most people do, different career aspirations over time. You know, there was a period where I really wanted to be a fiction author. There was a period where I really wanted to be an academic. And then I've turned out to just be a startup tech guy, which has been a long and fun journey.
You take the word "just" out of there. It's an amazing thing to be. So I think let's start with Plaid. So head of UK, I believe, entails just running that whole operation in Europe right now. Strategy, sales. Could you try and help us understand what you're doing right now? What a typical week, apart from when you're playing football in Haggerston, looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. I think first I'll just step back and introduce Plaid a little bit for people that aren't familiar or haven't read the headlines. We're essentially an API infrastructure platform that does open banking, and we build the tools that allow developers to build great fintech services. So we're sort of a background infrastructure player, but we support something like 2,500 fintechs today. The vast majority of all the big US fintechs and some of the biggest ones here in the UK as well are powered by Plaid. And so the journey in terms of what my role is now is I essentially am the GM of the UK. I actually started out as the product lead for Europe based in San Francisco. And then on a fun journey over the past 12 to 18 months, moved over, was first boots on the ground, found an office, set up an office, and have moved into running the go-to-market teams here in Europe for Plaid.
Okay, so seeing as we're going through Plaid, then that's interesting that at that point you were entrusted with taking the operation overseas and as an individual doing that. How did you get selected to be the person to do that? So you're in a head of product role in America. There's at this point still about a couple hundred staff over there.
Yeah, a little bit less than that, but yeah.
And then they've strategically decided, right, we need to be on the ground in Europe. And how were you the person who's selected to do that?
I think it was a little bit of hard work and luck and timing. So I joined Plaid knowing I was going to be doing product for Europe and being really excited about it. And one of the things I was excited about was the opportunity to come over to Europe, help build something new from the ground up. We were essentially building a startup within a startup. This was going to operate as a completely standalone, unique function. And so when I started out, I was basically traveling 1 to 2 weeks every month, spending time in London, meeting regulators, policymakers, potential prospects, talking with other companies that had done international expansion. And every time I would learn so much that I would come back and talk to the exec team at Plaid and say, we are learning more from the time we spend on the ground than when we're here. We just need someone there. And so actually we were looking originally to hire someone locally. And then it turned out, one, it's hard to hire remotely. And two, I just sort of put my name in the hat and said, well, I'm excited to move out there. And then I actually just got a call late one Sunday evening that said, can you move to Europe in 2 weeks? And wow. It was just pack a bag of clothes and get on a plane and start something new. So I think in that sense, I have had a little bit of the founder experience out here of just landing somewhere and trying to break into an entirely new market, which has been great.
And when you came here on day one, there was already businesses in the territory who are operating on the Plaid API.
Yes, we already had some customers that were here. We also had competitors here as well. So it's a hot space in Europe. And I think there's big differences between what Plaid built in the US and what we're building here in Europe in terms of the development of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
When Plaid got started in the US, it was very early days for fintech as a whole, and they actually sort of built key pieces of the infrastructure that allowed fintech to flourish in the US. Here, obviously, we're expanding to Europe, and fintech is the hot space in London. And so you just have to come in with a different mentality and a different hunger again to get back into that.
So you had some targets that you were aiming at to achieve in Europe. And from day one, they were expand the product lines into Europe appropriate to what the demand is, and fintech's big there. So how does that look today? What does the European business look like? And I suppose I want to compare that to what does the American business look like in terms of scale, size, numbers?
Yeah, so I mean, I can't dig into the actual revenue numbers or anything like that, but I think it's fair to say that the US business is operating at scale at this point, right? And if you think about the story of Plaid and how it got started, it was originally Zach and William, our co-founders, trying to build their own fintech applications and struggling to get off the ground. And part of the reason they're struggling to get off the ground is it's really hard to allow users who use many different banks, there are more than 15,000 banks in the US, it's insane, to connect to a single application. And so they started building that infrastructure, and then other fintech startup founders started coming to them and saying, hey, can we license your infrastructure from you? And Plaid just pivoted and became this powerful infrastructure player. But now you're at the point where you're powering massive enterprises. We're working with a lot of the large tier one banks as customers. Plaid is definitely at that scale. And in Europe, we're much more still in the sort of nascent stages of building a business here. So it's all about expanding countries and geographies, expanding new product lines, getting really close to your customers and figuring out, okay, for this market, what features do they need? Because you'd be surprised at how different all the various markets are. I think if you go talk to other fintech startup founders here in London who are trying to expand into the US, you'll probably hear them say the same thing, where there's surprising differences in how you have to change your product to work here. So for us, it's a lot about customer acquisition, market expansion, building the net new products here that are going to be exciting and build the business.
Yep. So you mentioned it's competitive. We had Trulair on the podcast recently, who I imagine is considered some type of competition.
Definitely.
You've got parts of Klarna's business, perhaps, that could look like it offers a same type of proposition. And I'm sure there's many more, and you'd be more knowledgeable about this. Could you talk us through the space and take us to where your offering is unique, if it is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think first you have to step back and think about open banking and what open banking is about, right? So there's the Payment Services Directive 2 that came into place in Europe and required banks to expose APIs. And so now you have small players, I would say, in every individual market in Europe who have aggregated those APIs, standardized the data, cleansed it, and offer a single connection. And so I think what you're starting to see and where Plaid is building a unique offering is we're trying to operate at a scale where we're pan-European. So we're competing with small players in every country that we're in, which makes it tough, but also exciting, because I think the real value, especially for larger fintechs, is we offer a great way for you to expand and grow and acquire more customers.
Makes
so I'd
sense.
Say that's a big thing for us. And then secondly, it would be the value you offer in terms of categorization, transaction standardization. So you could have, if you're a personal financial management app or an accounting platform, and you're using Plaid, you're getting really cleansed, standardized data that you can build great insights off of from many different banks. And that's actually a really hard technical problem to solve.
Yeah. Okay. So the scaling's going well. I understand that proposition and why, if you're a fintech in a territory, but you want to be in additional, that you choose you guys. Why would you choose to be acquired by Visa right now?
That's an interesting question. So I think I can't put myself into Zach and William's heads. Obviously, that's their decision. But I think when you think about what Plaid offers and the fact that we are an enabler for innovation in fintechs around the world, there are very few companies that were, one, big enough to acquire a business the size of Plaid, but two, where it would feel like a complementary fit, right? And if you think about the big card networks, they've built this amazing infrastructure that I think people take for granted now, that you can go pay with your phone everywhere, you can pay with a credit card everywhere. That is an amazing feat of engineering and infrastructure building. And we're doing that for bank accounts. And so I think there's this beautiful fit there where it's a different network. It's not in payments, but it's a very complementary offering where we're basically standardizing and making it easy for you to access something that will be a critical piece of the financial infrastructure. Yeah. And so I think in that sense, Visa and Plaid together will be able to build really exciting products that will offer lots of benefits to consumers, I think.
And the business will still push forward as a brand that is separate to Visa. There is the value in Plaid, and Visa see that.
Yeah, I think we're really big on the Plaid culture. And I think the Plaid brand is something that comes along with it. I think it's been amazing, the team and energy that's been built across all of our offices at Plaid. And so I think we're very much excited to keep that core. And so the only thing that will be changing is near term would be Zach will be working with the Visa executive team. But Plaid as a business will remain standalone. The Plaid brand will remain standalone. Again, the deal is still under review. And so, you know, this is assuming it goes through, but you never know. But yeah, I think the Plaid brand and who we are and the culture we're built, the offices we've built, I expect all of that to stay the same.
Yeah. When you were at Google, who's a huge acquirer of rip-roaring success businesses, there's so many examples. I don't know if you had direct experience of this from the other side.
You know, funnily enough, I did, and I've seen things that work well and don't work well. So I spent my last 2 years at Google working on the hardware team at Google, in particular on the hardware strategy team. And I was actually part of the deal team that did the acquisition of HTC in Taiwan. And I was also part of the integration team when we spun Nest back into part of Google, because it was originally one of the Alphabet bets.
Yep.
And then became part of the hardware team. And I think in both of those, it is a great lesson that it is very hard to keep culture intact when you're doing deep integrations. And I think one of the things that you have to really learn is to lean on the founders of those companies and to trust them in their judgment. So I think it's easy to think that you know the right decision when you're in a larger company, and it can actually sometimes work out poorly or really well, depending on how well you build that trust and relationship. And so I definitely saw both sides of that at Google, and Google has had some really great examples. Like, I think YouTube is a fantastic example of an integration and acquisition that turned out to be game-changing for Google. And part of that was keeping it as a standalone business and brand and letting it run and grow. And so I think that's important. And you have other examples of that around the Valley, things like Twitch and Amazon. So I think there's definitely a model here that works really well in terms of acquisitions.
Okay. So you got to be a senior product manager, director, whatever the title was. Let's try and understand from a career perspective that skill set. At Google, you were working in the hardware team. Come the end, right?
Come the end. And before that, I was doing business strategy and operations. But what that really means is you're sort of a business and product SWAT team that gets brought into new businesses that haven't built out their own dedicated teams yet. So yep. I did lots of project-based work on some of the really nascent stuff at Google.
Yeah. So first, to really understand that that journey to there, let's go back to education.
All right, to the beginning. I like it.
The head hunting walk through your CV. So I'll interview you now. So you're at a boarding school, right?
I did. I spent my last 2 years of high school at an academic boarding school called the North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics.
Wow.
And our
and so you had to stay there. You'd go there for a term.
You would stay there, yeah, full-time. Yeah.
Full-time. How'd you find that?
Honestly, it's still the best friends of my life are from that school.
Were you guys in like rock bands and smoking marijuana the whole time?
You know, actually, it was the complete opposite. Where really? We were all, because it was a merit-based boarding school that was sponsored by the state. And so you basically had to pass a bunch of science and math exams to get in, and then it was completely free. And so it was basically the haven for everyone who had been the outcast nerd in their old public schools. And so it was basically just this really amazing little ecosystem where you just pile all these nerds together and have them live together, and they're hacking stuff, and it's great fun. But it was a cool version of all the uncool kids from other high schools. Our mascot was the purple unicorn. So you can just, that sort of tells you the type of people that we had there. But I think that's where I really learned to love tinkering, building, and where I really went from enjoying academics to learning what you could do with the world around you. And that's what I sort of took forward into my career from that point.
And you went into a further education degree that was economics, maths?
Math and economics, yeah. double major there.
At that point, what were you thinking would be a good career path?
You know, I wish someone had told me this and had read my palm for me, but I actually went into university trying to major in theoretical math and thinking I wanted to be in academia. And by the time I realized I wanted nothing to do with that, I was about two courses away from graduating and credits in that, in math. But it was the type of math where, you know, the further you get along in university, the less problems you have on your exams and things like that. You're writing pages of proofs instead of doing problems. And so I think if I could go back and redo it, I would have definitely rather been in the applied math world and learned something a little more tangible. But I think it was good for me because I just followed my intellectual curiosity. And then that also led me to economics, which I found, I think they call it the dismal science, right? But it was just really exciting for me to think about all the things going on, because that was also right, I was in university right in the financial crisis, right? And so for me, that was a really exciting time to think about economics, the dark time. You know, I was watching it affect my family and my friends' families. And so I think I definitely came out of that with a nudge on, I want to do something in economics or in finance longer term. I tried out banking. The culture wasn't for me. So
you've got, whether it was exactly the maths degree or not that you, yeah, in reflection would take, you've got a really good degree. It opens many doors. Where was your risk barometer at this point in terms of the options of going to large corporate, going and being a founder? You know, you'd consider being an academic, decide I don't want to do that. You'd like tinkering and building things. What was the thought process there?
Yeah, so I don't think, I didn't have any burning ideas of I want to go build this. And so I didn't really consider the founder path. And to be honest, I think at that stage of my life, I didn't have the risk appetite to be a founder, for better or for worse. And so instead, I wanted to follow my nose on. I want to see and experience a bunch of different things in business and figure out what actually, you know, hits my fancy.
Cool.
And so when I would talk with people and ask them about that, they would often point me to consulting and say, hey, you should go do this. You'll get to work on problems at a lot of interesting companies, mm-hmm, and figure out what you do and don't like about companies' cultures, business problems, different roles. And I have to admit that I still think it's one of the best places you can start your career, because it certainly did that for me.
And you were at Bain for a couple of years.
I was at Bain for 2 years, yeah.
And that was a great decision then. You're happy. You did that because you experienced the advice people took, which is you work with different companies on different projects, experience things, open your eyes to what you might gravitate towards, and then you went and did something else.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's part of the consulting business model to bring in people, train them up, and then shoot them out into the world, hoping they'll hire you back in 20 years, right? I think that was definitely part of it. There's lots of things I didn't like about consulting, right? I think a lot of the projects are, how can you help an executive hit their numbers to get their annual bonus? When you dig down to it, that's what's driving a lot of it. But I think the variety and types of problems you deal with, and the culture of network of people that you're going to work with who are all smart, hungry, ambitious has just been great. I think a great example of how that can come full circle is actually now at Plaid, I report to the COO, Eric Sager, and he was actually my very first boss back in Bain days. We had no idea we were joining Plaid at the same time, nor that I would end up reporting to him. But that's sort of how these things go full cycle, right? It's that people can go off and have varied careers and they might end up coming back together at some point.
Where did you say it was Eric?
Eric, yeah.
Where did Eric go and spend his career before the full circle?
He was at Bain for more time than I was, then went to Square and led some of the sales teams at Square, and then was chief revenue officer at Bluevine, which is a lending startup in the Silicon Valley, and then joined Plaid as COO after that.
Yeah, so you hadn't shot ahead of him and then he is reporting to you. It's a shame, isn't it?
No, I think he's great, and so I'm very much excited to have someone to be working for someone that I can learn from again.
Good answer.
Yeah, exactly. Eric, if you're listening, be nice to me. but I actually, on that last point, I will say I think that's something that when I think about what's really helped me in my career, it has been following this advice, which is find people to work for that you're going to learn from. And I think I did that at Google. I did that when I was in academia, did that in consulting. I think that will serve you so much better than you think it will.
Yes, absolutely. So Keith, you get to the point where you've had a good couple of years in Strat, and you have to think through, okay, I want to go do something different right now. And you end up in a strategic role in Google to start with. But again, how did you choose Google in that specific role from the whole world of options that would have been open?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting how I ended up there. So I knew at that point I wanted to get into the tech world. It was what made me excited. It was the news I read in the morning. I was waking up and reading TechCrunch and checking Hacker News. And so at some point you have to lean into, okay, what actually gets me excited?
How'd that happen? Was that a project that you were on, or you had a peer group that inspired you who were working in tech, or you were reading these things anyway?
So honestly, it started back in that boarding school and had carried all the way through college. And I think I had just started to get the self-confidence and do the introspection to say, oh, wait, actually, this is what I do every morning anyway. I should just go work in this industry. And that, I think when I thought about it, that's what had brought me out to Silicon Valley, because I'd moved there sight unseen. I had negotiated to get my role out there. I was originally supposed to do consulting on the East Coast. And so I was sitting there thinking, I'm in Silicon Valley, I love tech, I should just go work in tech. And I actually looked at several startups at the time, and luckily was wise enough to realize that I was a really poor evaluator of what was going to be a good startup at that time. I think I was looking at mobile gaming startups right at the peak of mobile gaming, where, you know, 6-12 months later, they're all laying off people. And so I'm actually very glad I didn't follow my nose at that point. And so because I couldn't find the startup that was the perfect fit for me, again, I had friends tell me, you should go join this team in Google. It's called Business Strategy and Operations, which is a very unsexy title. But what the role is you do the project-based sort of early business model building for nascent bets at Google. I was like, great, this sounds amazing. So I joined it, and that's what it was. It was awesome. I did projects on Waymo, or the self-driving cars before it was called Waymo. I helped set up the early strategy for AR and VR, and I worked on a product called Google Wallet there. And that's where I really started to narrow from I love technology to I really love the intersection of technology and finance. And I carried that with me through the rest of my career at Google. But from that project, I got super into how is tech going to change finance, whether that is digging into the cryptocurrency industry, thinking about mobile applications and what happens when you bank only from your phone. I still think we're in the early stages of that. But I truly, when you look at the next generations coming, I don't think many of them are ever going to walk into a bank branch. What does that mean? What's going to change? I think those were the questions that got me really excited. And so I love doing the project-based work at Google, and that was what sort of helped me figure out where I wanted to take my career next.
Did you manage to stay on a continuous project that was focused on finance in Google?
No, I moved around to a lot of different things and then ended up following that in some ways to help work on the Pixel team at Google, which was trying to launch obviously their own Google-made device. And so that for me was incredibly intellectually engaging. Yeah. It wasn't directly in finance, but
what
it helped
skill
me.
Set are you developing whilst you're staying there? Because let's just go to that point where you've started working on Google Wallet,
right,
and it's brought the economist in you, the mathematician, the technologist, and you've thought, okay, this is really an area that's going to be huge and I'd like to be a part of it. But nonetheless, I'm at Google, I'm learning a load of stuff. This is a cool team. It's like some think tank that drops down to me, and then I get to get deep into the detail. So you must have been thinking, well, I'm enjoying it, I'm learning. What were you learning and what were you developing skill-wise?
Yeah, so I think the biggest new thing for me in that role was working really closely with engineers who are building things, right? And so you're going from doing business strategy work and analytics to working, sitting next to an engineer thinking, what products, what features are actually going to tick the boxes here? Yeah. And we did lots of really fascinating work where we'd run big consumer surveys and do a lot of stats work on what types of phone designs actually people are interested in, what features matter. Would they rather have a longer battery life or a full screen? Do they want a fingerprint reader? And so when you're thinking about that, it really got me into a consumer and customer mindset and to learn how to work with engineers. And obviously that sort of nudges you towards product work at that point.
That feels like a huge piece of strategy from Google. You know, their play on Pixel and what is the user experience for the consumer. And you're coming into that with, other than being really bright and having an understanding of analytics, which is really important at the beginning to try and work out which direction to go in from the insides. You're new to working with engineers. So how did you get into that role so quickly? What was the experience of, like, are you walking out of Google one day just like fist pumping there going, how am I, like, this is a dream. How am I involved in these type of huge decisions for them?
You definitely have those moments where you're pinching yourself a little bit. But I think the key is just to focus on doing your best work day by day. And then before you know it, you can find your way into somehow being involved in these big decisions. But the hardest part of all of this, and it was a skill I think I learned in consulting, was how to get smart or ramp up on a topic really quickly. So a lot of what I would do is I'd have my notebook with me. I'd be working with engineers. They'd be talking about, you know, so-and-so acronym, so-and-so technology. I'd go home and I'd Wikipedia wormhole for hours and just learn a ton about how things were working, how mobile phones were made. I went really deep on screen technology, silicon, all of these interesting parts of what goes into a phone that I had no formal training in, but you'd be surprised how much you can learn with a little bit of searching on your own. And so I think it was just a little bit of that, of this is something that really engages me and excites me. I want to go learn about it on my own. And you will naturally just over time get so much smarter and deeper in a subject, if that's how you feel about it, than you even realize.
Yeah. And this takes you into quite a senior role at Google, and you spend 5 years at Google in total on all these interesting projects that affect the world. If you could kind of help us visualize what outside of work is going on, you're living in San Francisco.
I was living in San Francisco. Yeah. And I was commuting a lot because I was working down in the headquarters for Google, which is down in another city called Mountain View.
Yep.
So I had a very long commute every day, which eventually grounds you down. But also Google,
so how long was
Google
that?
Was big when I, it was an hour and 45 minutes each way.
Oh, wow.
So okay, it was a serious amount of time to be spending even on the,
you could have been writing your short stories.
Infamous Google bus. Exactly. Right. But I think the other thing is that during that time, Google went from already being a big company to being a massive company. I think when I joined, they were 40,000 people. And when I left, they were 140,000. You know, it was huge. And so you increasingly have this feeling of, I'm a small fish in a gigantic pond. And I think what I realized is I wanted to go somewhere where I could have a ton of impact. And even at Google, even when you find your ways onto really important projects and you're working with really senior stakeholders, just the level of sort of bureaucracy and like the slowing of decision making that happens when companies get that big was frustrating to me. And I was thinking, I want to be somewhere small. So I started looking at small startups at that point.
But just to pause on that, you're at what title at this point in Google ultimately?
So it was just hardware strategy, general title at that point. So I was still advising executives.
In a company of, at that point, circa 100,000 plus staff who are all really ambitious and bright in different ways. If you were thinking, okay, but if I stay, I can get to the next title, and I stay, I can get to the next title. At some point, I can have a bigger and bigger impact. And you're also weighing up a number of things, such as risk, because there's probably little risk in this company. Impact, well, there is an impact, but my part of that impact is potentially smaller at the moment, but it gets larger. Would you be thinking, but I could become an executive in this business? That must have been the okay, I want to have an impact on something smaller. I get that you'd thought about it early on in your career, but just before I make that decision, I'm going to weigh up my internal opportunities. And what had you evaluated the next 5-10 years at Google could have looked like from other people you'd seen get to those senior executive roles?
Yeah, so I mean, I think you're definitely right that anytime you're working at a larger company, there's always a clear career progression, and you're always thinking, okay, what's the next level?
Yeah.
What do I need to prove to get to that level? But I think for me, when I stepped back and realized was the learning was starting to plateau a little bit. And so then you get to a point where you're searching more for title and the pay raise than you're searching for improving yourself and your knowledge. And once I realized that, that's when it was a little bit easier to make the decision of, okay, I think it's time for me to leave. At the same time, I felt that I had learned enough and my risk appetite had grown enough that I was ready to roll the dice on something, even if it went to zero.
Yeah, so I see a lot of people at this phase in companies like Google, where you know, there's almost this gold band where the money's got good enough that you can afford a lifestyle that is hard to to move away from with the added benefit of security. And there is still intellectual work to be done. So the review is if they're missing out on people like you staying, then something in their culture at that point isn't as good as it could be, because they should be catching that and at that point probably promoting you into a position where it addresses what you're trying to find externally.
You know, I think, yes, there's an aspect of that, but two things. One is changing culture, particularly when you're a massive company, is incredibly hard to do. And I think the other thing is that this is also natural. You can't, you know, if you hire a ton of ambitious people, you can't promote everyone all the time. It's just, you can't have a reverse pyramid. And so I think part of the way, and I love the phrase that our head of engineering uses is the valley is small and careers are long. But this is part of the way things work when you're in an ecosystem where you'll hit a point at a company where you say, I've done great things, I've learned a lot, I'm ready for the next step. And you move on, and there's no broken hearts there. I'm incredibly happy for all the experiences and learning I had at Google. It was the right time for me to move on. And I think, honestly, even if I had been offered a promotion or something to stay, it probably would have still been the right opportunity and time for me.
And at this next phase, as we discussed at the beginning of the podcast, you move to a different territory. So the difference, not even considering the job, the title, the size of company, between working in America and then coming to London. How have you experienced that?
Yeah, so I think for me, what if you think about what made my decision, right, is like at that point I had figured out I really wanted to be in fintech. So I knew an industry I wanted to be in. I wanted to be somewhere really small where I was going to have a ton of impact. And I was a firm believer that this industry was sort of at the beginning of a wave. And so I think at that point in my career, it was much more important to choose the wave than to choose the surfboard, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so I actually went and looked at a bunch of different small companies, some in the cryptocurrency industry, some more traditional ones. And I was trying to find my way. And actually, it was through an introduction of a friend of a mate I played football with that introduced me to Plaid and said, look, if you're really interested in fintech, you should go work at this company that's at the nexus of all the great fintechs that you're considering. And I started looking into it and immediately was like, this is perfect for me. Like I thought of it as working at Plaid is essentially like buying into an index fund on fintech, because we power so many of the big companies. I was going to get to meet and work hand in hand with so many great people in the industry that this was just the perfect place for me to be. And the role that I was interviewing for and that I was applying for was to help launch a startup within a startup, take Plaid to Europe, do something new. And so for me, it just ticked all the boxes.
And when was that? When did you join?
I joined, I think I signed my offer on Thanksgiving Day of 2018.
Yep. So at that point there, you know, 5 or 6 years mature, and then yeah. you're tasked with coming over to Europe and building the whole culture. So I want to talk about that.
Yep.
I think at the beginning of the podcast, I asked what does the week, what does the day look like? And then we talked about Vlad, and we've gone through the whole career. So let's get back to that, because it's really interesting. Like you say, you're what could be called an entrepreneur here, or you know, an entrepreneur within a larger outfit. So you take the role, you've chose the right wave, clearly, got better at that than at the beginning when you're mm-hmm. looking at mobile apps. And then explain to us what the journey's been like. What have you been focused on? What have you been doing?
Yeah, so the first portion of my role was essentially a product lead or product manager for Europe. And a lot of my time was spent working hand in hand with our amazing engineering team to figure out what do we need to build to be successful in Europe? How do we need to change our product to fit a new market? And so it's a lot of time doing analytics, being deep in Jira, spending lots of time with engineers again. And so my day was a lot of deep thinking and deep focus on sets of problems.
Engineers who are based in America?
At the time, they were based in America. Yeah. Yes, San Francisco.
And you're here?
No, at this point, I was in San Francisco there, yeah. and traveling. So I was half my time there, half my time traveling.
Yeah.
And so then I move over after a few months full time to be in London, boots on the ground, talking to customers. And then I was interfacing back with engineers in San Francisco.
Did you choose the offices?
I did. I chose our offices. I like toured all the co-working spaces, figured out where we were going to be. Yeah. You know, I think I really...
And where are you?
We're right next to Spitalfields Market.
Very nice.
We'll say Shoreditch, you know, it's close enough.
So you just, you walk in from Haggerston to Shoreditch.
Yeah, exactly.
For your commute. So it's not an hour 45 anymore.
No, absolutely. It's much, much better life out here. But I think the downside at that point, though, was, and I think a lot of people have experienced this working across the ocean, is I was working with an engineering team that was offset by 8 hours. And so a lot of late nights, just a lot of grind, where I'd spend my days working with customers here and businesses here, and my nights working with engineers in San Francisco. And so I think for me, that was a big lesson in learning how to sustain yourself, how to time manage better. Like a lot of the skill set that I think you need to develop in your career to become a leader was sort of forged in the fire for me during the process of expansion. And then when I moved into taking on the GM role here and building out a sales team, my day pivoted to less focusing deeply on specific technical problems and more lots of time recruiting a great team, lots of time interfacing with customers, lots of time in back-to-back meetings where you're doing lots of context switching. And you just have to set up yourself mentally slightly different for those type of days, right? So now I do the Silicon Valley trope of meditating in the morning and writing out what are my big goals for the day and really trying to structure my time wisely, because...
How do you meditate? Are you using an app like Calm or...?
So I actually use Headspace, yeah.
Right, okay, yeah.
Exactly. And I think it's just
how long does that take?
I just do like a 5 to 10 minute guided meditation, but I find it's just that moment of, okay, when your day is going to be back-to-back meetings the whole day, you need to make sure you have your headspace early in the morning and that you've cleared out and you're focused on, these are the things I really need to get done. And if I'm not set up schedule-wise to focus on those things today, make those changes.
So you have those things in your calendar, but you're talking about affirmations also. You write down... or bullet point a number of things that are the key goals for the day. Is that right?
That's absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
What were the goals this morning?
Well, I can't tell you that because they're business secrets, but we're working. So I have communications I have to get out to regulators, which is a big thing. I have a bunch of recruiting and final interviews I'm focused on. Yeah. I had the Monosearch podcast I had to prep for. So things like that, right? You're writing down, like, this is what needs to be accomplished this day, because otherwise... the day can just consume you rather than you consuming the day.
So we've got, as headhunters, I think a parallel where you are doing a multitude of tasks. And so we'll, at the beginning of a day, write out a day plan. So there's obviously a bunch of stuff in your calendar, which is external and internal meetings and priorities and tasks that are scheduled. But just writing out, okay, this is what happened yesterday. Like, here are the headline achievements that I need to try and really make sure that by the end of the day, I'm working through and I'm ticking off. And then at the end of the day, we'll reflect on that again. Just because one moment you're interviewing a candidate about their career, this person might be incredibly senior. The next moment you might be talking to a startup who's trying to hire a tranche of graduates, and you're doing a podcast, you know, you're going on a coffee. It's just all over the place. So the day can carry you away with it, or you can try and own it. And so I think whether you meditate formally or not, to have some headspace in the morning, you know, drink a cup of tea, whatever suits you, have some peace and just reflect and think, okay, this is how I want to attack the day. Then to actually write it down, put it into affirmations so that it's concrete, seems to be what a lot of successful people absolutely do.
I think you have to do that, especially when like we're at the stage of Plaid where we're growing faster than we can hire, right? And so there's always more to do than there are people to do it. So across the whole team, everyone's wearing multiple hats, right? Everyone is doing different jobs. And so you have to have this type of mentality, and you have to also be a builder and be excited to, yeah. I think going back to doing my own research and getting smart on things I enjoyed back at Google, you have to have that kind of mentality of, you know, maybe this wasn't in my job description, but I'm going to figure out how to do it.
So as a startup also, we're looking for a number of things. One of them is proactivity, mm-hmm. which I think is this research piece.
Yeah.
If we set a task, and we've got way too few people for the work that we've got, which is good in one way, but it can be stressful or it can be an opportunity.
Right.
Then we're looking for people to take the task on, but then actually to do additional work, have thought through what a solution might be, present it back in preference to come to us and like have failed the task. People are going to fail the whole time, right? That's not necessarily a problem, but it's how you think through proactively how to work through something, so then we're always iterating in a positive way. Which makes me consider, like, what are you looking for when you're hiring? So that's, I've got like a very small business that's scaling. You've obviously got this rip-roaring success, but where you're in a different territory, creating the culture, a large part of the role amongst other things is hiring. How have you gone about that? What are you looking for?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One of the big things, so we have sort of our cultural pillars at Plaid, things that we're really big on. One is we're looking for someone who's transparent, humble, introspective, like ambitious, and acts with a sense of urgency. I think that comes with the builder mentality is what we call it. But this is the type of person that really wants to just make things happen. And to your point, is going to be proactive.
Why humble?
I think humble is really important because there's no room for ego when everyone's doing everything, right? It's like part of my role is still stocking the shelves with water and figuring out where our office is going to be next, and like things that are by definition not sexy, but they're important and they have to get done. And you can't have people come in who their attitude is going to be, I'm too important for this role.
Yeah.
That just doesn't fit with our culture. And there are some places where that matters and that works. But I think when you're at a startup, that's just sort of a red flag right off the bat, is you have to come in. And if you're the type of person where all that matters to you is title or salary, I think that those are things that sort of send off flags as well, because what really matters is you want to build something great. You're going to learn a ton, and you recognize that this is going to be career making experience for you.
And how are you finding the challenge of getting both the people who on the CV, on the paper, experience is technically correct, but also then fit the pillars of culture?
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part. We take, a different tack than some other companies where we have quite a thorough interview process. And so we tend to have to interview tens of candidates for a role before we find the person that we think is going to be the right fit. And it can be a taxing recruiting process. But I think what that means is the people who make it all the way through are really hungry. They really want to be at Plaid. They're really excited about the opportunity. And so we tend to focus on hiring the right person, not the fastest person. And so I think it sort of depends on every individual company as to what their recruiting philosophy and style
is. How are you assessing that they fit the culture. So there's different stages. What part in that is assessing that? Is it you or someone else asking open questions and assessing in person, or are you putting them on various types of psychometrics, a combination?
So I think there's a few things. One is just they need to meet a good portion of the team, right? So it's lots of data points. Is this someone that you're going to want to sit next to and work every day? I think the other thing is for every one of our roles, we have a take-home type of assignment, which, you know, some folks don't enjoy that part of the recruiting process. But I think what it does tell you is, how is this person going to actually function in the job that they're doing?
Do you give them a time frame?
We do give them a time frame. Yeah. And so, you know, we're not trying to have someone spend a week on this stuff, right? We try and limit it to a few hours. But it gives you a really great sense of, how does this person think about a problem? How do they approach it? And then when they come back and walk you through it, you get a really good sense of culturally, you know, these are real problems that people are going to be solving day by day sitting next to you. Is this going to be someone that fits the culture of how we solve problems? And I think that's a great way to figure it out.
Okay. And in terms of how you're attracting the talent, are you using any of the recruitment technology tools for talent acquisition? Have you got yourself and a few people sat on LinkedIn sourcing the pocket? Are you using headhunters, recruiters?
So we have an internal recruiting team. And then we also just leverage our personal network, try and get out there. We host happy hours that function as recruiting events. We go to meetups all the time. We go to present at open banking or fintech events. It's a lot of just brand building and finding someone, because we really want someone who's engaged in the industry here and who's really excited about it. And so oftentimes those actually become great sources for us of finding the right people. And then it is a little bit of just doing the like recruiting on your own, reaching out on LinkedIn, trying to find the right people and see if they'll come have a coffee with you. And it is a lot of, you just have to dedicate time to it. You know, I think when you're at this stage, a lot of your day, if you're building a company or a founder or launching a new geography, 30 to 40% of your day is recruiting.
So in particularly Silicon Valley and London, you know, headhunters are prolific. So at certain stages or with certain philosophies, a company will buy into saving their own time for that talent to be introduced well qualified. It sounds like you guys haven't. What was the thinking there?
So I think we haven't, because what we're looking for right now, I think, fits more of our internal culture, and we have our own internal recruiting team and that works. I think for certain roles, it's definitely been something that Plaid has done in the past and will probably do again in the future. But it's not something that we do to scale entire teams. I think part of that is because we really like to keep the reins on our own process. And so I think it depends on the company, again, as to what the right fit is. I think there are people where it definitely works well. And I think for certain roles, again, it is definitely the right way to approach hiring. But I think right now, the way that we're trying to build our culture and scale a go-to-market team and an engineering team here, we'd rather have the leaders and recruiting team focus on that internally, because it's such a critical part of building a successful team. I think when you think about where we are in the market with open banking just getting started and Plaid being such an integral part of this and trying to build this pan-European presence here, for us, the biggest thing I can focus time on right now is trying to build a great team that's going to continue to get us there.
You speak with such passion about this culture that, of course, you've created, and you're a year and a half into the journey of having done that, and how you've recruited and the process you use. And look, you guys have a fantastic brand. So what we tend to find is if there's a fantastic brand, it's at a certain rapid scale, then you get an abundance of applicants. And it's as much about selecting from that and making sure that they're as on point as possible culturally, technically, and so on and so forth. But of course, tech has an issue with diversity. How have you looked at addressing that within your own business?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something that is incredibly important to us when we're recruiting at Plaid. I think part of what has made the culture so great is that we've brought in people with an incredibly diverse range of backgrounds, education, what they were doing before, what they're passionate about. And so I think when you put all of that together, it honestly reminds me a little bit about my boarding school, which is probably why I like it so much, where it's just a bunch of great, smart people who are totally different, slammed together in this business, building something awesome. And I think great examples of some of that is what it leads to is we ended up sort of organically creating something we call Platter Days, which is a hackathon we do. We actually have our next one coming up in a couple of weeks where everyone just spends 2 or 3 days, stops doing everything, and just focuses on hacking together something new. And actually some of Plaid's products long-term have come out of that type of thing. But if you start doing engagement like that, you will bring in a really diverse set of folks. I think it's really important to make sure when you're doing a recruitment and interview process that you're stepping back and not hiring people who are like you, right? Like that's the hardest thing to do is to step back and make sure that you're bringing in people who are going to challenge your thinking, who are going to come with a different point of view. And I think that's what diversity can bring to your business and make it more sustainable longer term. Because I think you don't realize the blind spots that you have. And so you bring in someone who's going to point those out to you. And that's the real strength and why I think diversity is a key focus and should be a key focus for anyone trying to scale a team right now.
And over the next few years, what's your aims? What's your vision for planning your...
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things. One is I think we definitely want to continue to expand and grow. I think we have a great start, an amazing product. But I think obviously there's more to Europe than just the UK and the countries that we're operating in today. So I think you'll see Plaid growing and expanding. I think the other thing though is that what's become a buzzword now of open banking is really just about access to for consumers to their checking and payment accounts data. Their current account data, I should say. I think you're going to see a shift to open finance, and you're already starting to see regulators and open banking implementation entity and some of these folks in the industry talking about that and what it means. And I think one thing that Plaid is really passionate about and that we really drive and have driven in the US is that a consumer's financial data is their own. They should own it, be able to access it if they want to, and be able to port it to a new service if they want to. And that goes far beyond your current account data, right? Like if you're a consumer and you have a mortgage, why shouldn't you be able to easily connect to another service and have them look at your rates and say, oh, actually, we can give you a much better rate than this. Or consolidate your student debt with one of our customers, for example, SoFi in the US will help with where student debt is a much bigger problem. That data used to be behind locked doors, and Plaid helps unlock that and create great services that ultimately will benefit consumers. And so I think you're going to see this shift from open banking to the new buzzword being open finance, which is about giving consumers access to their entire financial lives so that they can really improve their financial health. And I think that will ultimately benefit consumers long term.
A lot of the guests we've had on the podcast so far, if we get to that Mana part of why they're doing this, what's the mission that they're related with? Actually, whatever company they're in, it's somewhere around at the financial crisis, having wanted to contribute to making finance more trusted. And then right now being excited about some of the things that have just prevented people who could afford certain things actually be able to afford them through sensible credit ratings, just sensible, access to sharing of data. So what's the buzzword? It's
open finance.
Open finance. Open finance. Sounds like it's brilliant when that comes about. And therefore, who knows how long you'll be part of the mission with Plaid and trying to make that
Many more years of things to do. Finance is going to take time, but I mean, I think I would echo that motivation, like having got started in my career right after the financial crisis, seeing what it did to folks and thinking about how do we build trust and access back into this ecosystem? And what could that mean for people if it's out there? I think that is what drives me and what drives a lot of the folks at Plaid. And I think it's still early days for that. So I'm excited to see where it goes and, knock on wood that there isn't another huge recession in the wings at this point. But I think there's still a long way to go to provide real healthy options to consumers out there.
But you know what? If there is, and at some point there'll be some form of recession, it doesn't always need to be as dramatic as the last one, then actually some of these solutions will help people through that time, right? Because you aren't necessarily in some type of defaulting product because of the open access. So you can't stop the economy from having a recession, but you might be able to prevent some of the dramatic effects it had on less fortunate people last time, and actually therefore.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you're trying to help build a floor underneath people, right? And I think part of that falls on the government, but part of it falls on the market. And I think there are great businesses to be made helping people through those things. They don't necessarily have to be diametrically opposed.
And you get to look at a lot of them because you service them through Plaid, but just broadly, generally, in the market right now in fintech, is there a particular company or area that you're really focused on and excited about?
Yeah, well, I guess I'll highlight one company that I'm personally passionate about, but I think Clio is doing a great job of helping this for young people, right? It's like you can connect all of your accounts and it will help you figure out how to save more, right? And how to live a healthier life. And I think you're gonna move towards a world of automated savings over time. And so I think there's lots of companies trying to attack that space. And I think that will be really interesting when you get to this point where you can trust a program to run your financial life better than you. And then there's a ton of value in that. I know I personally would find a lot of value in that, but you have to build up that level of trust and security. I think that's something that, again, Plaid is really important, plays an important part in the ecosystem, is to make sure that you're building a trust with the user, that we're safeguarding your life, we're safeguarding your data, we care about it as passionately as you, so they can then trust your service and trust that you're going to bring them value.
Very commendable, Keith. What an exciting career you've had. Absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.